Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, I'm Gary Bloom, and you're listening to On the Sporting Couch. I'm a sports broadcaster, counsellor and psychotherapist, and that means I work one-to-one with all sorts of people who are having or have experienced problems in their day-to-day lives. It's sometimes called a talking therapy. It doesn't mean the individual is ill or sick. It just means that they feel the need to discuss the things that are going on in their lives because they're going through a tough time. The goal of therapy is to understand ourselves better. One in four of us will experience strong feelings that can overwhelm us at some stage in our lives. My training allows me to work with people who are experiencing mood disorders like anxiety, depression, performance anxiety, relationship and work issues, and addictive behaviours. I'm undertaking this project to help widen the understanding of mental well-being in sport and beyond. Nearly everyone listening will know of someone who's been in this position at some stage, and hopefully this programme will give a greater understanding of what goes on between therapist and the person who today is on the sporting couch. Meet Marcus Trzaskowski, arguably one of the best opening batsmen this country has ever produced. He represented England in 76 tests and 123 one-day internationals, and was one of the first names on an England team sheet between the years 2000 and 2008. However, his glittering international career was decimated by debilitating bouts of depression and anxiety, which forced him into international retirement at the height of his England career. England's loss was his county's gain, and he continues to play county cricket with Somerset, and this coming season will be his 25th as a professional player. So, in the next hour, I hope you'll hear what I think is a really brave admission by an elite sportsman, that the life they were leading as a professional wasn't all it looked like from the outside. Welcome to On the Sporting Couch with me, Gary Bloom, and Marcus Trzaskowski, who once said, "The beast of depression ruined my test career." I'd like to start where your book starts, your autobiography, almost 10 years ago, March 2008. Mm. And you're in a electrical shop at Heathrow Airport, about to board a flight to Dubai with your Somerset team. Can you explain what happened there?
Pretty much, yeah. It was just a case that we were going on a pre-season trip to Dubai. Only a couple of weeks, I think, 2.5 weeks sort of journey, just for, you know, early season as you do. Got to the airport and just realised this overwhelming sense of anxiety, panic, if you like, about not so much getting on the flight and travelling. It was just, you know, being away from the family, insecurity that that it comes across me once I get to that position. So it all became too much, and I ended up then speaking to the coach, and that was it. The rest is history, and you sit down and discuss, and then you decide, right, I'm not going to go, and there's a big problems about getting bags off flights and things like that, but it was just the normal feelings that had suddenly come rushing back to me at that point.
Can you explain to somebody who might not quite get what happened, what were the feelings you had about leaving your wife and your children behind? Mm. What were these sensations?
The anxiety is general anxiety, you know, you get the sweaty palms, you get that nervous feeling in the back of your neck, in your head, your brain's going at 100 miles an hour thinking, what if?
What is the fear, Marcus? What was the fear?
I don't know. I think it's just a case of being away from the security of what I know. You know, going to a foreign country, being in a different hotel, being away from your security blanket of being at home in your own bed and being with your family there. Just you lose that. Once that's taken away, it's suddenly that panic comes over me. And it's funny because I've done it loads of times and enjoyed it loads of times and still do now. Like, we've just come back from Spain only 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
We spent 10 days over there, pre-season trip. Why can I go there, but I couldn't go then at that time? Who knows? But, that sort of feeling of panic and uncontrollable anxiety just gets too much.
You see, as a therapist, I've picked up the word security blanket. Mm. And that suggests something that is very, very old, that goes back to when you are very young. Mm. Do you think there was elements of this anxiety when you were very young?
Mm. Oh, definitely. It first came to fore when I was 10, 11. We went on our first sort of trip away with school down to Torquay, and living in Bristol at the time, a couple of hours away. And I had exactly the same feelings. I always put it down to just being homesick, being away from the security of what it was, and just, you know, you get used to it after a few days, but that lived with me for a long, long time. But that was the feeling of when I was 10, 11, was exactly the same sort of feelings that I get even now when I have bad spells and deal with, you know, the whole process of it.
So what does homesick mean to you? Because it might mean different things to different people.
Mm. Yeah, well, I just put it just being away from my family. You know, I didn't think about anything else of what it was. I just, you know, being away from what I do day to day, waking up, playing cricket, doing what I did, go to school, whatever it was, and your family are there, your mum, dad, your sister are there. And suddenly I was in a totally different environment and they weren't there. That's what I always thought it was. It didn't appeal to me or didn't seem to me that it was any more than what it was at the time. Only as time goes on, then that changes and you get a better understanding of it.
And do you think that got transferred over to your wife and children?
Yeah, it probably did. I think the anxieties of what you get when kids are around, the extra burden that you carry, the extra stress you have of having these little bundles here that you've got to try and look after and try and care for. And then that was the time then that I said almost enough is enough. And that's when it came to a real head in 2006 when I was in India.
Mm.
And it was the second trip I'd been away from my first child. And it was just, no, this was far greater than that it'd ever been. It was the homesickness times 10, and everything was far greater than what I'd really appreciated it was going to be.
Reading your autobiography, it becomes evident that your family life is built around the game of cricket, and in particular in the area you live in, Somerset. I just wonder whether those really strong family relationships became too difficult to move as you started growing up and becoming a professional cricketer?
I don't know the answer to that. I grew up, through playing cricket. My dad was playing. Mum used to do the tees. My sister used to come and watch. She had no choice. But I've just been involved with it all the way through my career and all the way through my life from a very, very young age. And then we played it at weekends. We practiced it in the gardens. We did everything we could to do so. And you just get engulfed in it as much as you can do, don't you? But, you know, and then it builds on to then bigger and greater things, playing professional, and you just understand that you're doing it for a job also, but, you know, rather than just playing it for the love of the game. But I think that's what keeps me going even now. But it's an interesting thought that you just get wrapped up in everything cricket that goes along.
I'd like to just look at the key relationships in your life growing up with mum and dad. How were they?
Very good. Very simple. Nothing too stressful or nothing very different about, you know, anybody's life growing up. Any particularly difference? But obviously, I had a sister. She's 3 years older than me, and very caring family that would run as per normal. Dad had his own business, and mum and dad worked together doing that. It's pretty simple life, I guess, if you look at it in that fashion.
And Dad was heavily involved in cricket in Somerset, wasn't he?
Yeah, Keynsham Cricket Club, where we sort of grew up playing and being there watching all the time. He's now president of the club. And we were there a lot. You know, during the summer holidays, we were there every weekend. You'd be there a couple of times during the week, and it was just a very social place that we'd be as a family. Because obviously we were playing, but also events that were happening there along the time we go and watch as well. So, yeah, it was just, you know, something you were born into and can never get away from.
So were you closer to mum or closer to dad?
Good question. I guess in the sporting context, obviously I was closer with dad because obviously he had a understanding more. I'm not saying that mum didn't, but he knew a bit more about the game. He coached me more. He was coach of the teams that I was playing for. But they both came to watch 99% of the games anyway. But mum would have been more the opposite side of things, so dealing with my school stuff and general day-to-day life and living, I would suggest at that point.
So how was it early on when you realised dad couldn't make it to see you play cricket, especially if it was an important match?
I don't think there was many times. I think most of the time they would have been there. The very odd occasion, maybe, if dad was working or something. Mm-hmm. I can't remember, physically can't remember, any games that they weren't there. I'm sure there were games where they didn't turn up. Of course they did, but I don't remember particularly any.
And when you became a professional, when was the first time you realised I'm on my own now at the crease? Mm. Mum and dad aren't here. When was that? When did you realise that for the first time?
Well, it wasn't a problem when I was playing because I was very focused on what you were doing. Still travelling away, you used to, you know, I spend winters at home for the first 3 or 4 years. So I'd go home in the winter, practice and do where I could and train, get myself ready for the following summer, and then move down to Taunton come April time. And even those sort of periods, yeah, the first couple of days, or maybe a week or so, would be a little bit nervous and anxious about what I was going to do, but I soon settled into it. But I was still returning home quite regularly back to my parents on a weekend to play club cricket and see them and carry it on from there, really. But, you know, it wasn't that far away. You know, I'm only an hour up the road. And it wasn't until I was 20 that I fully moved down full time. But I still go back and visit as much as you could do at that sort of time, even then. So,
were you able to talk to your mum and dad about being homesick?
Once or twice I did. Yeah, once or twice I did, and let them know that, you know, I feel this. And
what did they say?
Just to try and get on with it. I know that sounds quite harsh in a way, doesn't it? But, you know, just to try and get into what I was trying to do. You know, get into the cricket or get into the school trip and try and not focus on it as much as you can do, which is, you know, I can understand it, but it didn't work. I couldn't control it very easily. The only thing that made it control was just being secure and comfortable in my surroundings and where I was.
I suppose the word I'm looking for is, when do you feel safe? Because it strikes me, reading your book and having met you before today, that safety is a really important part of your life. Mm. How do you make yourself safe in the world?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. I don't know. You just get comfortable, don't you? And I'm very secure in my life. You know, I'm a lot better than where I was a few years ago, obviously. The help of medication and dealing and understanding the process of mental illness has helped get a bit of a grip on it. It's still very average feeling when you fall back into a few problems. As anybody knows, that, you know, it comes and goes at times, and it's hard to get rid of. But, you know, I just like that feeling of just everything in order, everything sorted. I know what I'm doing tomorrow. I know where I'm going to be next week. Do I cope with things that throw me out of kilter? Probably not, no. So anything that unsurprising sort of is thrown at me, I'm like, whoa, you know, just, okay, let's get plans in place and get everything in order and get back on track.
What happens when you are on your own?
What, nowadays? Mm. Nothing, really.
Because that was a fear of yours, and we talked the last time we met that you've never actually lived on your own. You've lived with pals, other cricketers, then you got married. But, and I said to you, could you live on your own?
Yeah. The only time I lived on my own, sort of, is when I first moved down to Taunton. I lived in a flat at the cricket ground. No one else was around, but my girlfriend was around the corner, and I used to spend quite a lot of time there. But I would have been in a flat on my own at that time, but not for very long, only a couple of months. I guess I like people around me. I like to have that social time around me. When I feel bad now, I spend as little time on my own as possible, unless I'm out doing the gardening or trying to occupy my mind to make sure I'm focused on it, just to keep my brain busy. But I guess having the people around me makes me feel comfortable, and knowing that I can talk to somebody if I need to, or they can help me out with something. Something to rely on, I guess, and more than anything else.
I mean, looking at the bigger picture, the times that your anxiety is at its worst is when you go to a foreign country, you know you're going to be there for several weeks.
Yeah.
What are the fears that play on your mind in those situations?
Everything that I've said, it's the feeling of being away from the comfort blanket of knowing your own home, knowing your own bed.
But you've been staying in 5-star hotels and food's laid on and transport.
It's kind of irrelevant almost, because you catastrophise everything that goes on.
And for people who don't understand what catastrophising means, can you just explain to it how it works?
Just like making a mountain out of a molehill, basically. The smallest thing can be what you're concerned of. What am I going to eat for food? What if I'm in India and suddenly the food is really bad? How am I going to prepare myself for the game tomorrow? What if I wake up ill in the night? Who's going to help me get through it? Everything that you can do on a normal basis and you're very rational about on a normal day-to-day basis, you catastrophize and make into this huge problem in your own mind. It's not a problem when you're actually rational and understanding what you're doing. It's just your brain goes into overdrive and, starts stressing about the smallest little things.
And when that happens, how do you know it's about to come on or you're in the midst of a full-blown panic attack?
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever had panic attacks. It's just general anxiety, panic, which has stayed constant for 24 hours, really.
And how do you know it's happening?
Just by the emotional feelings that you get, mm-hmm. the sweating, the not wanting to eat, not wanting to drink. Sleeping goes out the window. You're tired in the days. All the little signs that come along, and you then have to try and put things in place. But it's just that emotional feeling that you get when the anxiety is there.
You're listening to On the Sporting Couch with me, psychotherapist and sports broadcaster Gary Bloom, and Somerset and England opener Marcus Truscothick.
You thrive on anxiety, if you like, when you play cricket.
Why?
Because that's what makes you better. You couldn't go out and face somebody who's bowling 100 miles an hour if you just got out of bed.
You see, the paradox for me, talking to an international batsman, is I would be absolutely, facing a bowler who's about to bowl at me for 100 miles an hour. There you are, as calm as you like, great hand-eye coordination. That doesn't bother you.
No.
Worrying about your next meal does.
Yeah, well, worrying about the smallest little things does, absolutely. Because I've trained that for so long, I've practiced that since I was a little kid to get myself in that frame of mind, that you just programmed your brain to get there. So you can almost switch into the right side of the brain to make sure you're focused on what you've got to do. You walk out to bat, and get on with what you have to do. You use the adrenaline, you use the anxiety to make you move faster, to make you focus better, concentrate more, and just be aware of the situation. You don't walk out and be aware of the crowd when there's 50,000 people there. You can hear it, but you're not aware of everybody talking because there's so many people talking, you don't understand it. When you're anxious and you're worrying about things behind the scenes, it's a different process altogether.
Like many sportsmen I've spoken to on this programme, very often being on the pitch is the best place to be. It's when you get off the pitch that all the problems start. And definitely. I know there's been one or two key examples where that's not been the case for you.
Mm. Most of the time it is. I agree with you totally that, to stay on the pitch is the best place to be, just purely because you focus on watching the ball and doing the job that you have to do. It's when you have the time to think and the time to sit down. I don't want to be alone with my thoughts when I'm feeling poorly. I try and distract myself away from the feeling as much as I can do, because being alone and just having time to think about them is then when you start catastrophizing everything and building everything up as much as you can do. The more I can distract my brain, the quicker things settle down as much as possible, and you get back to an even keel. So you can almost feel the sense of the brain just being totally out of control, and when it's almost coming back into to where it should be, in line to what you normally think, and control along that way. So,
can you tell us about the times when you have taken that anxiety onto a cricket field?
Oh, yeah, quite a number of times. So the first time, I guess, in India when I first came back. in 2006, I was out there batting, knowing full well I was done, you know, and I knew that any point I could just break down and cry, and fought the tears back a few times while actually out on the pitch. You know, luckily you can just turn around and face the next ball, so you've got to be pretty focused on what you've got to do. I only got 35 or so, I think it was. And then I walked off and completely fell apart. And that was obviously then the part of the written all in the book about being in India and suddenly what was going on. I remember Michael Vaughan saying to me, "What's wrong? Just sit down." I said, "I can't sit down." All this adrenaline and panic just going through my body that I couldn't control and understand. So that was one time. Then, what was it? It would have been my first year as captain of Somerset. I remember my first game up at Leeds. I felt awful going up into it. And I asked my parents to come up just to give me a little bit more support, just to try and help me out more than anything else, just get me through the first week. And I almost considered the night before my very first game as captain to, you know, resign, because I couldn't cope with the pressure and the anxiety that I was feeling. But, you know, you go out the next day, and I felt the whole game, I felt pretty rough. But I remember the first innings, won the toss and we batted. And I knew then at that point I had to really bat a long period of time, because I knew if I'd gone off the pitch I was going to break down and crash and just sit there crying my eyes out. And I really, really didn't want to do that on my first day as captain. Lucky enough, I batted for best part of 5 hours, got 120, walked off, and everything started to then fall back into place.
So it's interesting that, you know, it's at this time when you're promoted to captain of Somerset, that it's mum and dad who you call upon to give you that emotional support. Once again, your safety blanket.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That was just an easy thing to do. And I guess it's probably more the after the game is done, just to give me that support to help me relax and understand more of what's going on, and try and control the anxiety to sit and talk with them enough and make me try and get back to that rational brain thinking. And we spent the week there, 3 or 4 days there, played the game, and by the end of the game I felt absolutely great. 4 days done, and then we had like 2 days in between and we played another game, and going into the second game I was fine. Just because my brain was in totally the wrong space, I couldn't cope with understanding or working out how I was going to do it. So having that little safety blanket there, just to get myself back in the right frame of mind and then understanding what I needed to do, then I knew I could do the job after that, and loved doing the job. It's just you when you're poorly and you're ill, your brain convinces you can do nothing and challenges you to do all the smallest things.
What support have you had from your teammates throughout your career dealing with mental health issues?
Well, they've been very good. I guess luckily that I opened up to them very quickly and let them know the extent of what was going on once I'd understood it and got to grips with it. I then let them know that these are the problems I get, this is what I got to do. It almost become a bit of a joke in the changing room that, you know, that what I suffer with, and I guess it normalises it a little bit and makes it not quite as painful as what it can be. Because everybody knows now that, and I'm free to talk about it to anybody, and I try to talk about it as much as I can do.
But that's not always been the case, Marcus. And there's a fairly sizable part of the book about the cover-up when you had to come home from a tour.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was mainly because I wasn't sure what was going on, and then obviously not comfortable to talk to people about it. And it builds. You get that to that point where you can go, okay, I'm ready to talk now.
If people don't know what happened, can you explain about the cover-up and the Sky TV interview?
Yep. So the first time I came back from India, I was back for a few weeks, and I then arranged my own way. I wanted to do an interview to talk to people. Got to the morning and got to the day of the interview, and then I suddenly realised this was not something that I wanted to do. Carried on and did the interview, and when the dreaded question of, you know, why did I come back from India, I replied with I had a virus and came back. I did have a virus, I was ill, but there was obviously clearly more other things that were going on which were deeper. And that sparked then people to ask further questions and start hounding you, as they can do, on your doorsteps and following you around to try and, I just guess not invent stories, but really try and work out what was going on. And there was a few other issues then that were being talked about, but Clearly not, you know, obviously not true, none of them. It was just a case that I wasn't ready to explain to people what was going on, mainly because I didn't know what was going on.
I'm going to go on to another tough topic, sledging. Mm-hmm. And I personally find the practice of sledging, speaking to a batsman disrespectfully, who bowlers know have a mental health problem, quite abhorrent. Mm. Can you understand why I would think that?
Yeah, I do. I think there's a fine line between general sledging about what goes on and then saying things to somebody about a personal issue. I don't believe that happens. There's only one person has said a couple of things to me when I first finished playing with England, and that was back in 2006-07. That was the small minority of what it is. We're now 10 years down the road. People have never really said anything that's going to affect in that way. They've sledged me, they've chirped me on various other topics, but never about being, you know, a sufferer of mental health problems. And I would hope that that doesn't happen in any walk of life, as you wouldn't if somebody was suffering with another illness. You wouldn't draw upon that. And people have crossed the line, don't get me wrong, but you'd kind of hope that that doesn't happen.
Can you remember what the comment was?
Something about going to see my psychologist or something like that, I think it was. I only come up here to see your psychologist or something like that. And I was a little bit, yeah, that's bang out of order. And I guess at the time I was probably a little bit timid about it. If someone said anything to me about it now, I'd jump all over them.
What would you say?
I don't know. I'd probably lose my rag, and I don't lose it very easily.
What happens when Marcus Trzaskowski loses his rag?
I'm out of control, really. It's just you know, I would take a bit of time to calm down probably and get back into playing the game, but because I think it's the ultimate disrespect, really, isn't it, for what you can try and do?
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You see, meeting you and actually having this conversation with you, Marcus, the word that seems to strike me is you're very controlled, very, very under control. I just wonder what it's like when you lose it.
Yeah, it's not something I do very easily, and it's not something I particularly enjoy when I do. I would probably only really lose it a great deal at home now and again when I get annoyed with something, or if I'm out, sometimes I lose a few not friends, but I throw a few things around the change room. Sometimes I've been known to kick a few things or hit a few things, fallen over a few times when I've kicked and slipped and done that. But I am very controlled. I don't like losing control of my emotion of it. I try and stay in very much in control of it as much as I can do, because I want to be as level-headed as possible. But
I think what strikes me is when I'm working with people who say very similar things to you is I can understand why you don't particularly want to feel the bad things because they're very painful. Mm. But by being in control, it also limits the joy that can be brought into your life. Do you think that's a fair comment?
Ooh, tricky one. I don't know. I still enjoy everything that comes along, and what more is there? Can I sit back and enjoy? I try to enjoy everything that now is thrown at me in life.
But you don't strike me as a man who's going to throw your head back and laugh uncontrollably.
Maybe not in this situation. No. You would get my teammates, no doubt, would give you a totally different perspective.
What would they say?
Well, I don't know. You'd have to ask them. But I'm the person I am within the changing room and within a private environment would not be potentially the person I would maybe portray within the public image. I guess publicly I'd be quite calm, quiet, controlled.
And in the changing room? Gives a flavour of who that other Marcus Truscothic
is. When I'm more relaxed, it's a lot easier just to chirp and to have a laugh and joke about. And yeah, I'm a very different person there. When I'm relaxed and comfortable where I am with people, and knowing that nothing bad's going to happen, but just knowing that I'm happy that I can not be myself, but be that type of person in amongst players.
What type of person?
Just a relaxed, normal person. I don't try and necessarily be any different to the public or to the people that necessarily don't know me as well. But I guess I generally am. I guess we all are, in a business sense, compared to a home environment or a comfortable environment where they're going to be.
Welcome back to On the Sporting Couch with me, Gary Bloom, and Somerset opener Marcus Truscothic. Your autobiography more or less finishes at the time when you've packed in international cricket and you've said goodbye to England. So what's happened between then and now in terms of your anxiety about travelling abroad?
Well, has it changed? Maybe a little bit. I've continued to try and explore trying to do it. And want to get back to that time. I used to love touring. There's parts of touring which were absolutely fantastic. You know, we spent the last three pre-seasons with Somerset in Spain at Desert Springs, a place there which is built, you know, they've got the cricket facilities and do whatever they do. And that has been outstanding, you know, just to get that time away again and knowing that I can potentially start doing this all over again. Could I go away for a month now? Probably not right now. I'd want to build it up and go away sort of 10 days, 2 weeks, you know, and get back into it that way.
So what's the difference between being away for 10 days and, for example, 3 weeks? What's the difference?
Well, I think it's just to build up my confidence to it at the moment, you know, more than anything else. Rather than jump into it and go, right, I'm going to be away for now 3 weeks, just build up my tolerance to the levels of what I can and can't do.
Mm-hmm.
I think then, you know, I'm comfortable with probably a couple of weeks away at the moment, you know, and I could probably mentally I can cope with that fact that what I'm going to do, but I wouldn't want to jump straight in and go, right, I'm going to go away for a year or 6 months on a cricket tour. That's not probably the best way that's going to be suitable for me. So building it up gradually and working over a period of maybe a year or so, or a couple of years of doing different trips, I'm going to manage to do so. But
and yet you made clear to me that if you were to take a three-week break with your wife and two children, that would be fine.
Yeah, no problems at all, yeah.
Explain to me the difference.
What, comfortable. I have my comfort blanket around me, isn't it? The people that are most close to me right there and there, they can understand me, they can keep me busy, they can help me through it and go with it that way. It's just having that security blanket there.
It's funny
me.
The word security blanket keeps coming back into our conversation, isn't it?
Just having it there is the key, you know, just making me feel happy that it's okay. If I'm not happy, I can turn to my wife and say, A, I'm not happy, can we try and sort this out, or let's do it. Or I might make it happen even without her knowing. It just gets my brain back into the position of where it needs to be.
Let's look and talk about being married to Hayley. Have you ever hidden stuff from her in terms of your mental illness?
Yeah, and continue to do so, really. I sort of deal with various days, or I might have a couple of days where I'm feeling a bit under the weather and not quite mentally how I want to, and I don't burden her or the family with it for as long as possible, until I get to the point where I think, okay, now I need to try and probably take a bit of time out and just sort of get things under control, then I'll let her know. But it's normally at quite a I guess a late stage, if you like, more than anything else. I just try and, because I deal with it on numerous occasions, where I just get myself back on track So there's no need to, you know, to bring her in too much and let her know everything about it.
You see, one of the curious things about depression and anxiety is often the sufferers isolate themselves, and actually what they need is company and understanding of other people. And it's almost like you're a classic sufferer in that respect.
Well, I like the company. I would do everything I know that works to get me and my brain back in gear, but they may not know why I'm doing it.
But I don't understand what would be the point in not sharing with your wife from the get-go that you were going through a tough period.
I think just the adding extra responsibility to them.
And does that work for her? Does she ever turn around to you and say, you know, Marcus, thank you for not burdening me with this?
Yeah.
Or is it more likely she'd say, you know what, you should have said something.
Yeah, you should have said something, as you do, as everybody does. I feel I can cope with it to a certain extent. That's why I don't burden people with it. Because I can cope and understand it and get myself back on track without anybody else knowing. For a certain period of time, anyway.
I think it'd be really useful to hear what those coping mechanisms are, because there'll be many people listening to this radio broadcast saying, well, how does Marcus deal with it?
Well, medication, I guess, is the first part of it. I still continue to take two medications now daily. So I take an antidepressant in the morning, I take an anti-anxiety in the evening. So that is something that can change, obviously, overnight, if you like, if you start to become ill again. Especially my anti-anxiety, I can up and down the dosages on that fairly easily. There's little things like I try and time manage quite well, in terms of, right, I have like a time diary, if you like, and it would be day to day, hour by hour, of my time when I wouldn't be working. So it generally comes at the end of a season, when I know then I've got a lot of period of time off, I would hourly program in, walking the dog, taking the kids to school.
You actually have to write that down?
Yeah, just it's a mental thing more than anything else, to know that my time is taking up and I'm not going to have all that period of time sat there doing nothing, worrying, watching TV, doing absolutely nothing. And it will be as simple as taking the kids to school, walking the dog, doing the garden, cutting the grass, whatever it may be, just so I can program it in. I do like to keep myself really busy, so I would overwork when I'm feeling poorly, because I don't want to sit there and dwell on everything that's going on until I get to that point in the evening when I know that things calm down, and then I will relax and understand it, because it's just I want to try and keep my brain focused on a task, so it knows that it's not going into overdrive and catastrophizing everything that's going on.
Do you ever allow your brain just to idle and meditate?
Not when I'm ill. No, I don't enjoy the feeling of it. I have meditated. I have, you know, you do various things. I've tried it. I haven't particularly had much great success with it. I don't particularly find it gives me a great deal that I would take away and then use on another occasion. It's, you know, the couple of things that I would put together. The medication is vitally important, and the time management is key for me, and then obviously keeping myself busy as much as I can.
Because it sounds like routine is everything for you, Marcus.
Yeah, I do like a routine. Yeah. When things are in place, it's comfortable. Then it's when the changing of the seasons or the changing of the times, that's when you get thrown out of kilt, really. And it's just not quite. It takes a little bit of time then just to, you know, reboot and get back into the next system of whatever it's going to be, whether that's the end of the season, the kids breaking up from school. I got to get used to it and know what I do and understand it again.
It sounds like flexibility is not something that comes naturally to you.
No, probably not. No, I like to be structured, you know, in pretty much everything I do. There's other parts of my life I'd be very unstructured probably, but I like control and understanding that it's all my eggs are in, you know, my ducks are in a row, and just knowing what I do from day to day. My wife would say differently, that you never know what you're doing. Or, you know, why can't you tell me what you're doing in a couple of weeks? But I don't like to try and book too many things into that. But I do like to keep busy as much as I can.
And what would you say has been the most effective therapy that you've been involved in?
Cognitive behavioural therapy is something that continues on. I probably should have mentioned that to that last question. It's also something that I use and have a therapist that I continue to go to. The same guy that I spoke to was the first person I worked with when I first came back from India in 2006. So I have him available as a friend as much as anything now, that he knows me, he likes his cricket and we can go and talk and work things out.
People might not have heard of cognitive behavioural therapy, sometimes called CBT. What are the sort of things that he would work with you on? What sort of techniques would he give you?
Well, first and foremost, it's getting there and talking, explaining what I am feeling and how my brain is working, the symptoms I'm suffering with, if there's a problem, what is that problem? How can we work it out? How can we resolve it?
So kind of problem solving?
A little bit, I guess. And I'm sure there's a few different techniques he would use, probably some that I'm not even aware of that he's trying to do. But I think you've got to challenge the problem more than anything else. If there's something in my brain which is causing me that issue, then we need to try and resolve it. How are we going to resolve what the issue is? Is it something that we can go, okay, do this and it will go away? Or is it something, okay, we have to put a long-term process in to try and work it out? And sometimes you meet with these therapists for 3 times a week. Sometimes it's once in every 6 months. It just depends on what you try and do. But it's having that sounding board there. And I do rely on them in the fact that they can tell me that the symptoms that I'm suffering with are normal to the disorder that, you know, you suffer with. You know, so when you say the anxiety is making me do this or I feel like this, and they'll go, yeah, that's classic to what you should be feeling. This is a natural emotion to how you should be responding to the problem that you're foreseeing. And it's not always a problem. It's sometimes that you invent it in your own mind that causes it. But, you know, now I've got a bit of a grip on it myself, I can almost implement those and understand those. And I guess that's part of my own coping strategy, that not telling Hayley why I do this is because I can start to cope and start to get myself back on track without speaking to these people a little bit until certain points, and I feel enough is enough.
One of the interesting things about talking to you is you're not desperate to know why you are who you are. You're very keen to find out how to resolve the problems as they come up, but the why is something that you'd rather keep in another country.
I don't see how I can't give an answer to why, because it would be somebody telling me why, because I'm not aware of it. If I haven't worked out why, then I can't control why. All I can control is if I pull a hamstring running between wickets like I very often do, how can I get better? How am I going to get my leg better so that I can play cricket next week? Or I've got a punctured tyre, how am I going to get it better? Go and get a new tyre, whatever it may be. And it's exactly the same process. I don't know why. I don't want to know why. It's irrelevant to me.
Why don't you want to know why? Because many people, given that your history of mental health and all the things that have affected your career, would say, I really want to know why this has affected me from being a little boy. But that's not you.
No.
That's not a criticism.
No, absolutely. I don't have it's nothing burning inside me to know why, because I don't think it would make any difference.
Is there fear?
No, there's just no desire. What difference does it make? Okay, you tell me why. I was brought up in a certain fashion, whatever it may be. Okay, deal. Let's move on. What is it going to achieve now? What are we going to achieve by finding how or why this has happened?
The counter-argument would go that you would understand it better and you would resolve it and maybe have a different path to resolving this long-term, because you're a relatively young man. This is going to go on, presumably, for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
There are people who would say, listening to this broadcast, well, finding out why is the key to the problem.
Okay.
I know you disagree with me.
Yeah, that's not in my mind. I don't see as...
And this programme is not here to find out why, but my fascination, and I'm owning my fascination here, Marcus, is to really understand why you don't want to know why.
Because I just don't have any desire. It's really not in me to go, I want to know why. I'm just happy to keep control of it, because it's horrible when it goes out of control, so you want to know how to put it right all the time.
And is the fear that if you try to dig into the why, that it might leap out of control, almost like a genie out of a bottle?
I've never thought I could probably solve the problem. In the last 10 years, 11 years, since I've really understood what depression, anxiety is, yes, you want to be better and you want it under control, but I've never thought, how can I cure this? Can I cure this? I don't know if I can. So because I'm not sure if I can, I've never even thought, oh, let's go and cure it. Let's try and cure it. So that's that. Those thoughts have never come to my mind to go, let's put it to bed forever, because I don't know if I can. I don't know how. And I've never thought I could, necessarily. I may be totally wrong, and you will know more than me, and therapists know more than me, and the people the experience of it know more than me. But
well, I tell you what's the clue for me, Marcus. I'll be absolutely honest with you. There's a lot of avoidance going on. Keeping yourself busy, having the timetables, making sure your mind isn't idling. That, to me, it seems like a defence mechanism. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a way of you avoiding really looking at some really powerful stuff. That's how I feel as a therapist.
Mm.
But you're looking me over the table as if to say, I just don't want to go there. And that's fine.
Yeah. I'm not. I don't. No. No, I have no, as I said to you, I have no aspirations to try and work out why. That's just, I see it as a coping mechanism to getting myself back to how I am today. Being able to come and talk to you about it and just be the day-to-day person that I need to be. That's how I cope with it. Defensive, yeah, it may well be defensive, I'm not sure, but it's just that's how I've learnt to deal with it.
And sometimes I feel like a bowler when I'm with you,
and
you're playing straight back towards me.
Yeah, quite possibly. Yeah. Yeah, if you look at it in that way. Yeah.
What would you say to a young cricketer who might be listening to this this broadcast, or a young sportsman who recognises a lot of the things that you're talking about? Mm. What would your message to them be?
I think seek help more than anything else, and that would probably consist of talking to somebody that you trust, and that would be maybe a parent or a friend, a colleague, something like that, obviously, or a doctor, to try and then just put the wheels in motion. As I talked about before, one of the biggest things that helped me was acknowledging the fact of what it is and understanding and coping with it. But you've got to seek help somewhere along the line. Once you've solved the problem or shared the problem with somebody, then you can start to put wheels in motion.
I'd like to know from you how important sport has been to you in terms of a plus in terms of mental health, and how much has it been a minus in terms of mental health?
Well, minus obviously in the last few years of my England career, that, you know, struggling with it while I was away, obviously then that was pretty tough. And in within the public eye and explaining it to people, you know, trying to let people know, that was fairly tricky to start with. Positively, I've used my brain in great ways to, you know, to help me play cricket, and that is the key to my success, having my brain operating and concentrating to make it work, and that has helped me greatly. You know, you get you to a point where I am now, having played 6 years of international cricket, which was brilliant. I would love to have done 26 years, you know, but wasn't to be. But it, you know, you use it for good things, you use it for bad things. It's just trying to understand why.
And what does the future hold? You're about to enter your 25th year as a professional cricketer. That's some going.
Yeah, I'd love it still. Yeah, you know, my body's not quite in the shape that it used to be, and it takes a bit more out of you from on a day-to-day basis, but, you know, the passion for it and the love for the game and wanting to do well, it's still there. You know, I'd sign a 5-year contract now if I was allowed to carry on playing. It's just there may be other factors that sort of inhibit it that and stop it, you know, lasting that long. But who knows, really? I think I will carry on playing. I want to carry on playing for as long as I can do. It's just whether the club obviously foresee that happening as well.
Do you fear retirement? Because obviously you're going to have to try and keep yourself busy at a time when you've finished playing cricket.
Yeah, I guess you do. Yeah, of course. I think it's a tricky time in everybody's sort of career, if you like, because I love the feeling of putting the pads on and going out to bat and practising every day.
But you could play club cricket.
Yeah, no, it's not quite the same. You know, the day-to-day meaning of what it is that... I guess I'm starting to plan for that. You know, over the last probably 3 or 4 years, I now... you know, working in different areas. I now only play 4-day cricket, which gives me a great opportunity to work in different departments and industries. I work at local school where my kids go as a cricket coach, Taunton School, which, you know, during the winter in particular, I'm there quite regularly. And that continues during the summer. Then I also do work on the TV, the punditry stuff, with you know, on the cricket. And you know, you put those sort of wheels in motion. I've come straight from the PCA today. We had a benevolent fund meeting discussing, you know, how we can help and the next stages of trying to, you know, help people with mental well-being, gambling problems, addictions, whatever it may be. So Irons in the fire, I guess, more than anything else, but it will be a sad day, no doubt about it, once I decide enough is enough.
So you see cricket as the rest of your life in some shape or form?
Definitely, definitely. In what shape, yeah, I'm not sure, but it will be involvement somewhere.
And if Sky Television said, Marcus, we've got a tour of India coming up, we'd like you to go out there and be as part of our commentary team for 6 weeks, what would you say?
Right now, if they asked me, I'd probably say no, because, you know, I don't want to jump straight into a six-week period. I would discuss with them and try and manipulate it into a fashion. Can I come and do 2 weeks? And now I'd say yes or no, and then we can discuss around it. But I guess that's part of my goal, is to get back up to that point where I'm comfortable enough when the kids are old enough and maybe moved away, that I can accept those sort of job offers to then be involved and maybe potentially do it.
Do you see this inability to be abroad for long periods of time without your family as something long-term, or something that you feel you might just defeat one day?
I think I will need to build it up, of course, as I've been talking about. But yeah, I'd like to think that I can get back on top of it. It might not be something that will be cured long-term and completely go away and never have any problems. But with the help of, you know, the things that I've learned, but also the medication that I can take, definitely calms the feelings down, so you can cope with it a little bit easier. So, you know, long term, let's hope it gets back on track and I can do a 6 week stint and have no issues.
Suppose you and I were to meet in 5 years' time, what do you think, what would you like to be able to say to me in 5 years' time, yeah, about what you had done to progress your life forward?
Well, I'd like to say to you, right, I'd still sign another 5-year contract and carry on going till I'm 50. But I very much doubt it. I would like to think that we've moved forward, that I'm now a coach in some capacity, either with Somerset or beyond in other counties or other areas. That would be my objective, first and foremost.
In terms of your career, looking back now, Marcus, as an international cricketer, county cricketer, what would you say that you have given to the game, not just all the runs you've scored, but the insights that you have managed to share with us?
Tricky, isn't it? Mm. You help youngsters, of course you do, and I will continue to do that probably more as I get older. The biggest thing that I could probably say is that I have a huge love of what I do, and I try and give that to the team, the day, the innings that I'm playing, or whatever it may be, to be the best I can be. And I hope I would leave that on the as a lasting legacy, really, that just had a huge passion and love for what I did.
And surely, I think you're being immodest, if you don't mind me saying so. Because I think one of your huge legacies is you've allowed people to talk about mental health in sport, which is absolutely enormous.
Mm. Yeah, I tell you, and it's probably more for people to say, rather than me sort of pinpoint and say that, like, I've left this with the game and understanding. But I appreciate it is obviously writing the book and talking about it. You know, I'm more well known for that, the mental health side of things, rather than potentially the cricket that I played for 20 odd years, or for 6 years of international cricket. The mental health side has probably influenced more people along the way. You know, the letters that you receive, emails you receive, when I wrote the book about helping people and saving people, that was very, very nice to see that, you know, we've made a big impact on it for all the problems that I'd suffered and continue to do so. We're helping people to understand it and hopefully get better and just get more control over what's going on in their own life, or solve the problem, like we say.
Marcus Driscothic, many thanks for being on the Sporting Couch.
Thank you.
You've been listening to On the Sporting Couch, a programme that attempted to lift the lid on mental health issues in sport. I'm Gary Bloom, psychotherapist, counsellor and sports broadcaster, and my guest in the studio has been Somerset and England opening batsman Marcus Driscothic. I hope the programme will have encouraged anyone who has, or knows anyone who has, mental health issues to come forward and get help. And there are some useful links on the TalkSport website, talksport.com/sportingcouch. I'm Gary Bloom, and please remember, there's no such thing as good health without good mental health. Goodbye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.